Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 20th, 2005. This session is Cosmic Evolution and Genesis, Part 1, Bible Study with Paul Santmeier. This disc is SAP 2005-01.
This is a series, but each of these Bible studies is self-contained. I hope that I will be able to hook you enough today so that you'll keep coming back and that you'll be able to get the whole picture of this message that I'm going to try to bring to you. This is not an uninterested Bible study, discover this, discover that. I have an agenda. I want to convince you in this session and every session, essentially, that the Bible is a green book, and that this is not something that is a wild ideal of a few wacko environmentalists, but it's in the text if you have eyes to see and ears to hear. Today we're going to be looking at a very familiar text, Genesis 1. I gave some thought about whether I really wanted to include the word evolution in here, because that suggests all sorts of stuff that you may be wrestling with in your school boards and things like that. We can get into discussions of evolution and things like that if you wish. That's not my point here. My point is to, with you, work together to open up this holy book here, particularly Genesis 1. I don't know how it is where you live, but I'm a city boy at heart, and you frequently have this experience. You know, you pull up to a stoplight like this, and then a kid probably pulls up next to you, and you're sitting there, and you're boom, 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 boom. That's the way it is. This Bible is going boom, boom, boom. Its message wants to get out, and I'm going to try and help you hear this boom, boom, boom that's going on in the Word of God, in particularly in Genesis 1. But before we get to the text, I want to do just a little bit in terms of our theological setting right now. Because when you come to the Bible, you just don't open up the Bible and read something. You come with your own set of assumptions and your own expectations, your own eyeglasses, as it were, to read this text. And we could look at the cultural situation that we're in. I don't want to do that here because we don't have time. But specifically, I want to set out as best I can, where we are theologically as we approach these texts. Let me begin, pick a convenient date, 1970. That was the year of the first Earth Day. That was when people in North America and other places in the world began to wake up to the fact that we have what I prefer to call an eco-justice crisis on this planet. And as people began to wake up to that fact, that there is an eco-justice crisis, there arose within the popular movement what's been called the ecological complaint against Christianity. It was argued that Christianity is not going to be part of the solution of this eco-justice crisis, that drawing on Christianity is sort of trying to put out a fire by using kerosene. Why would anybody, I mean, we're good people, we're nice people and everything, we have Bible fear and folk. Why would anybody think that Christians are the problem?
Well, if a person thinks that, I'm upstairs.
Okay.
If you think that everything is for the life hereafter and not for this life, then you might not be concerned with those kinds of things.
Okay, so there's a possibility of an otherworldly Christianity. We know that's been translated very much in recent years into this horrific left behind theology, whereas, you know, the pilot disappears from the plane that you're on and is raptured, and the earth goes to hell, basically. So that's there's the traditional otherworldliness, and then there's this apocalyptic otherworldliness of left behind. Why else would...
Because we are commanded to have dominion over everything. And
okay.
That's missing.
Dominion is a four-letter word. it is bad. We want to look at that because this text begin to hit us right here in Genesis 1. The idea is the earth is there, here for us to use. It's the perfect capitalist text. You know, exploit, or Marxist text. Exploit the earth. The earth is the means of production for Karl Marx.
I think we misunderstand who we are in the text as human beings, too, with the word imaging. You know, we become very anthropocentric, very human-centered.
Okay, that's another word that goes with the dominion thing, that we are so focused on ourselves and perhaps on our class that we don't really care. We don't know about interaction. We don't know about ecological systems and things like this. And hence we have global warming now and so forth. So dominion, that's another idea, otherworldly. Anything else that why people would think that Christianity is a problem?
So historically, you look and see who have been people who have done these things, and largely they come from the Christian West, so it seems empirically true that Christians have caused the problem.
Okay, so this is a descriptive kind of fact, Western imperialism and economic development and all the rest, not unrelated to the dominion text, as it has been used by the dominant classes in the West. If we had more time, I would tease this out of you, but in my mind, I'm thinking of one thing that particularly the eco-feminists talk about a lot that's bad with Christianity, and that is God is transcendent. God is up in heaven, far away from us, and the point of the spiritual life is to rise above this earth and to enter into communion with God, who is pure spirit. And we who are created in God's image are also transcendent. We're not implicated in this stuff. That's God has dominion, we have dominion, and so we have a divine right, as it were, as transcending creatures to do what we please. That's the popular critique.
Yeah. Just to add to what she said, and they said, what comes down to is misperceptions of who Christians are.
Because
the real meaning of having dominion isn't what people can perceive it to be.
Okay, well, we got to wrestle with that, because one of the words subdue, which we're going to get to in the text, means trample on. Okay, so we got to look at the text as it is, yeah, you're on my side, I'm on your side. I mean, this is where we're going in terms of this Bible study. Well, so this happened, the 1970 Earth Day happens, then the ecological critique of Christianity arises, and in significant measure in response to this emerges Christians and who say, well, that isn't true. And in this response, there are roughly, this is oversimplifying things, but there are three kinds of responses on the part of the church's spokespersons. There are the apologists, those who say, basically we've been misunderstood. Stewardship is taught in the scriptures, and that's not a bad idea as long as you understand it aright. And there have been some very sophisticated and biblically astute interpreters of this, saying that if you understand the Bible right, you don't have to change basically
what our Christian inheritance is, but just get it interpreted more correctly. We have people like Thomas Dare. If you are looking for a book to read on that presents the most powerful statement of the stewardship theology, it would be Douglas Hall. He has a couple of books. And then you have all the way over to people on the Christian right, like Richard Neuhaus, and in the political world, the ideology that goes with the Republican right. Stewardship now is a beloved concept of the political right. Stewardship, wise use. Millions and millions of dollars have gone into creating institutes, have gone into publications to show that Exxon, for example, is being a good steward. Okay. So you have the apologist saying essentially that stewardship, rightly understood, is what we need to respond to the critics of Christianity. That is then taken and the powers that be run with that concept. A second group of people I call the Reconstructionists. That is, they basically buy into the thought that Christianity is ecologically bankrupt and make a very good case of it. My own dissertation advisor, Gordon Kaufman, still makes the claim that Christianity is essentially a moral faith that has to do with persons. Well, what about things? You know, what about other kind? Well, that's important to Gordon Kaufman now, but he says that it's not in the Bible. The Bible is really about God and humanity. And there's much in the whole stream in the Christian tradition that gives testimony to that fact. Among the so the whole thing has to be rebuilt. You got to go to the ground level. And anybody who's ever done any building knows that, or read the New Testament, that if you don't have good foundations, the whole building is going to come crashing down. So the Reconstructionists want to rebuild. So you have people, sort of thoughtful, sober analysts like Gordon Kaufman. You have a range of others, process thinkers like John Cobb. For those of you who are new to this kind of talk, if I say something like process thinkers and you just don't know what's happening, just wait, I'll pick up with something you can relate to in a minute. But for those of you who have been around for a while, I just want to sort of give you some handles so that you know where I'm taking you on this. There, and among the Reconstructionists, you also have people like Matthew Fox, who thinks indeed that Christianity is the problem, who believes that the so-called fall redemption theology of the Christian tradition is what caused the environmental crisis. And we have to get rid of that fall redemption theology and get back to a creation spirituality. And some of you may like Matthew Fox. I hope to talk you out of that. but you should realize that I speak at college campuses from time to time, and sooner or later some undergraduate will say, "Have you read Matthew Fox?" So we have to take the seriously, I'd say much more seriously, people like Gordon Kaufman, but also for cultural reasons, Matthew Fox. And then among the Reconstructionists also are a whole group of eco-feminists. People like Rosemary Radford Ruther, Sally McFay, who believe that It's not just the ecological complaint against Christianity, it's a patriarchal complaint against Christianity. That Christianity is so thoroughly patriarchal that we really have to rebuild the whole thing. It's not just a matter of changing language, it's a matter of changing how you think and how you live and everything else. And this is a profound critique of the Christian tradition, because on the face of it, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and all the rest, on the face of it, we are dealing with what appears to be a very patriarchal religion. Those are the Christian feminists, self-conscious Christian feminists, card-carrying Christians. You know, you need to read them if you haven't read them. There are also post-Christian feminists like Mary Daly, who started her career by writing a book, Beyond God the Father, and began to end her career going off in all sorts of directions that have nothing to do with Christianity except to say that it's bad. So you have a group of people who highlight the stewardship idea. You have some Reconstructionists who, as you can imagine, want to counteract the whole dominion thing, the whole transcendence thing, who emphasize immanence of God, biocentrism, and so forth. There is a third group of response to the ecological complaint against Christianity, which I call the revisionists. And I hope to show you that we're right. sort of a clarion call of revisionist theology began with the now classic address of Joseph Sittler to the World Council of Churches in New Delhi in 1961. Before Earth Day 1970, where Sittler, looking at the Paul's letter to the Colossians, particularly Colossians 1:15, following, argued that the church has to have develop a cosmic Christology and really learn anew to speak with the Bible in terms of care of the earth. Other names that might be part of this. I think the single best book, and this is a revisionist book, the single best book on environmental ethics is James Nash, Loving Nature. That's one you can write down. It goes over a whole range of issues. The challenge for the revisionists is something like this. Can we have another Reformation? I mean, for thousands and thousands of years, the church believed that, to put it crassly, in one way or another, you have to work your way into heaven. Maybe not. That's very crassly. But let's just say that that's an adequate statement. That you have to do your part. You have to have merits in order to get into heaven to be saved. There was this monk in Germany that was perplexed by this. There was a crisis, a cultural crisis. People were full of guilt. People did not have certainty of their salvation because, you know, you never know if there are enough works. You got to do something better. You got to polish your life a little more, and so forth. And so there was this cultural crisis that of lack of security, certainty of salvation, that the whole society was shaped by with the selling of salvation, but the church economics had invaded the church and so forth. And this monk, Martin Luther, was reading the scriptures. He's a scripture scholar, and he came upon Romans 1:17, the just shall live by faith, and had this enormous aha experience. So there, for hundreds of years, I'll say, there was all this going on. The whole church taught this with some major exceptions, but, and Luther reads the scripture and has this aha experience. Now, what I believe is possible, that the church in our time can have an analogous aha experience. We're not going to set aside the texts from Galatians and Romans that so shaped Luther's response to the crisis of his time, but our crisis is not so much the internal crisis of certainty of salvation and things like that. It's an external crisis. So we need to listen to other texts that address the crisis that we're a part of. We're not going to set aside justification by faith. We're going to thank God for the insights of the Reformation tradition. But we are revisionists in the sense that we're going to hear the Bible in a new way, in a new situation, just as Luther heard it in his time. And for us, then, texts like Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 and 3, Job 38 to 41, a range of New Testament texts that you might have not paid too much attention to before. Obviously, Romans 8, the whole creation is groaning in travail. Revelation 21, we're looking to a new heavens and a new earth. We're going to look at those texts and have those be the texts that go boom, boom, boom for us to hear, rather than the justification text. Now, if I had more time here and would want to respond to this temptation of having a captive audience here, I would say some things about current Lutheranism and preaching, where you still hear justification by faith Sunday after Sunday after Sunday, and meanwhile the world is going to hell. There is an eco-justice crisis, what with global warming, which is now putting the humane life on this planet in jeopardy. But I won't do that now. We want to get to this, these texts. Oh, part of the revisionist...
will you put those texts up on the board later on, just so that we can read them by ourselves?
Yeah, okay. All right, class, take notes. Genesis 1 today, Genesis 2 tomorrow, Job 38 to 41 the next day, and then a bunch of New Testament texts. And we're going to end by looking at St. Francis's reading of the Christmas story. Whenever I say a text, I'll
thank you. I got those down.
Okay. Part of the revisionist task is to, with these questions in mind, has been to revisit our tradition and to discover in what sense it is anthropocentric, what sense it is has this very domineering view of dominion, and I always promise my wife before I go to make at least one plug for my book, The Travail of Nature. I'll pass this around. One of the things that I tried to do in that book is to show that there are really two major traditions of Christian thought about humans in the creation. An ecological tradition and an anthropocentric tradition. Beyond that, the good news is, from 1970 to now, there has been a revolution in biblical studies about human and the creation vis-a-vis the creator. Two books that, which are tough reads, unless you have some theological or biblical training. One is by Theodore Hebert, The Yahwist's Landscape. And that was published in 1996. Theodore Hebert, H-I-E-B-E-R-T, The Yahwist Landscape.
that's dealing with especially Genesis 2, but the whole Yahweh's trajectory in biblical studies, in biblical theology. And the other, William Brown, The Ethos of the Cosmos, in 1999. William Brown looks at Genesis 1, 2, Job, the wisdom literature, and other aspects of New Testament trajectories of faith and witness. And the difference between what I had to deal with in 1970 and through the early 80s and what we now can deal with in terms of biblical studies is enormous. So, end of introduction, 1970s, people are aware of the eco-justice crisis, the ecological complaint of Christianity arises. There are three general kinds of responses to that. The apologists who particularly highlight the idea of stewardship and want to emphasize that. The Reconstructionists who think that Christianity in this respect needs to be totally reconstructed. And the revisionists like Joseph Sittler and myself and James Nash, who believe that it's a worthy project to revisit the tradition, to go back to the scriptures, to listen anew with fresh ears. And the overall proposal I want to make to you in these Bible study sessions is that the theme that jumps out of the Bible like a boombox is that for me is not stewardship but partnership. That God enters into a partnership with the creation and calls us to image forth God's partnership with the creation. I will say that again and again and again. That is my agenda, to convince you that basically is what's going on in the scriptures. Any questions about that preliminary stuff before we get to the text or comments? Yes.
I'm not sure what you mean by partnership.
The question is what I mean by partnership. That's what we're going to be working on. And although I'm tempted to be like the old preacher, you know, who has three parts to his sermon, I tells him what I'm going to tell him, I tells him, and then I told him. I won't tell you. But that's what we're going to be working on.
I was just wondering if the Earth Day, you know, you say that was kind of the breaking point. Was that what really prompted all of, other than Joseph Sittler, who was forewarning, but were there other Christian theologians prior to that began to strike this theme? Or was that really a turning, was that a future?
Well, theologically, things have been going on.
Of course, I guess St. Francis would probably be.
Yeah. Well, and if I'm right that there are two major streams of Christian thought, that kind of stuff has been going on for a long time. I'm just giving you sort of the public report of when it became something that the newspapers wrote about. For example, this week or last week, USA Today announced on page one that now everybody is convinced that global warming is a fact. Now, for 10, 15, many more years, the bulk of the scientific community has been moving in that direction. But suddenly somebody announced it, and, well, it must be a fact if it's on page one of USA Today. So the Earth Day is a sort of convenient place where it became a popular question, and then people began to look around and say, wow, the church hasn't been saying much about this. I just learned the church to love God and my neighbor. What about all this other? So it's just a convenient way to talk about larger trends.
Yeah, I agree that Earth Day is a good marking point. I can't speak for world history, but in American history, we had John Muir a long time ago in bringing up wilderness preservation, and Rachel Carson writing in the 60s, but really, like Mr. Stammeyer said, Earth Day is a useful turning point to use because of the sudden widespread people paying attention to it.
Okay. I do want to get on to the text. Some people have to leave in 10 minutes to go sing with the choir. I won't comment on the choir director doing that to this class. So I do want to have at least get them a chance to do some textual work here. Open your Bibles class to Genesis 1. You all know the drill. How many days? We're already delighted.
Seven.
So when someone says eight, no. One of the interesting things about the days, and it was the first day, and it was the end of the second day, and the third day. Did you ever notice that when you get to the seventh day, the text doesn't say, and it was the seventh day. What's going on here? The suggestion is, Gerhard von Rad and other Old Testament scholars have suggested that what we have to do here in the materials that are gathered in Genesis 1, which have a long history, maybe going back to David's times in the temple and then emerging during the exile, what we have going on here is a testimony to, as these priestly writers so-called gather these materials, a testimony to something that is ongoing. And von Rad even says that the Sabbath and the seventh day is eschatological. Now, don't let me scare you with that term. If it's new to you, if we're looking toward the heavenly, the new Jerusalem, the new heavens, and the new earth, which is images that came in later, if we're looking toward the future of salvation, that has to do with last things, that's eschatological. Rod says that this Sabbath is almost a kind of a future thing, as which you enter into as you keep the Sabbath every week. So we got 7 days. We have other things in this text that repeat themselves. One in particular,
it was good.
I never really counted up how many times before this morning. Does anyone happen to know how many times? And it was good. Well, often. You have the image of God now being a kind of a master builder, and if you've ever had an experience like me of being sort of an amateur carpenter, you know, wow, that piece of wood looks good. Now let's see, what am I going to do next? I'm going to put this here. Now, I screw up and cut wrong and things like this. God didn't. God somehow has an interest in every single stage, and it turns out just right till God gets to the very end. And what does God say then, according to the text, when it looks at the whole project?
Very good.
Okay, Genesis 1:31. Note that there's a divided history of interpretation on this text. You have people like the venerable Saint Ambrose who read this text and say, God looked at the human creature on the sixth day and behold, everything was very good. Text doesn't say that.
But what was it in the Christian mind, heart, and spirit that prompted a very learned exegete like Ambrose to just simply misread that text? Something going on. But the text does say very good. God looks at the whole project, and we want to see that it is a whole history or a whole project that's going on here. Bertrand Russell once asked the question, well, if God is so interested in humans, why all the ichthyosaurs and dinosaurs and everything else? I mean, why are the creeping things? Why not get right to the point? Because that's not the point. The point is this whole creation that God wants to have a history with, leading, especially as we know from the New Testament, toward a final fulfillment where all things are made new. So, and God saw that it was good. It's thoroughly good. And by the way, the creeping things are good. Note, the same, and this is important in your discussions when someone says, oh, it's, you know, some of your environmentalist friends say, oh, look, it says dominion. That's, you know, how can you be Christian and be an environmentalist? Well, the same hands, the priestly writers, also shaped the Noah story. And do you ever think, why did Noah take the unclean with him? I mean, if he were a good Jew, that would have been a marvelous time to clean things up. He took the unclean, the creeping things. Why?
They were all good.
God's commandment.
God's creation.
It's God. Because that's what this story's about. It's not just about us. The whole thing is very good. Noah takes all the creatures with him on the ark. An interesting, to me, an interesting part of this text, let me draw your attention to Genesis 1:11. You have, keep your finger right there, I just want to introduce that a little bit. You have this notion of God speaking and it comes into being. There is a sense of, a sure sense of divine power there. And there may well be in the mind of the people who shape, the minds of the people who shape this tradition, a sense of kingly power. You know, the king says, go, and you go, and so forth and so on. That the king's word is law in that sense. But notice here in Genesis 1:11, then God said, let the earth put forth vegetation, plants yielding seed, fruit trees of every kind, and so forth. God enlists the earth as a partner. That there's a cooperative relationship here. God is not just acting by fiat. The earth has a part of the story. The earth is a player in this narrative. I mean, the earth has its role to play. Similarly, in Genesis 1:20, and God said, let the waters bring forth swarms of living creatures, and let the birds fly above the earth across the dome of the sky. The waters are enlisted in a kind of partnership with the Creator. The Creator remains the Creator, but the Creator works with the world as it is. There's a kind of a responsiveness and a certain even dependence that God gives the earth space, as it were, to do its thing. God gives the water space, as it were, to do their thing. That there's integrity in these creatures. They're just not the result of divine fiat. We're the product of not just a divine word, but a divine word that is interactive with the creation. And let me just jump around here and then get to the, we'll go right to that text that is as the crux of so much concern. Although there was one other, where are the stars in here? Anyone help me on this?
Verse 16.
Yes, okay. Notice as a sort of prelude to the discussion we're both going to get into, verse 16. God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night and the stars. That expression there in Genesis 16, to rule the day and to rule the night, is the same Hebrew that's in the expression for dominion. It's just translated differently. So already we're given a clue here that something may be going on in this dominion text that we're just approaching, because the sun and the moon are not Adam Smith. I mean, the sun and the moon, you know, are presiding in a way over the whole creation. There's a kind of almost liturgical function of the sun and the moon presiding over the creation as priestly presiding over a liturgy. So we're already given a clue that we have to be really cautious about concluding what these dominion texts mean. That it's not automatic, that the word itself doesn't tell the story. Although word studies are important. You know, we look at Genesis 1, 28. I already mentioned that word subdue there in the Hebrew is a very harsh word. It means tread upon. And let me just step back from this a moment. I would like to suggest that what's being depicted here is creative intervention in the earth. There is going to be intervention in the earth. If you're going to build up human community, you got to cut down trees, you got to build roads, there's all sorts of things that if you're going to fill the earth, multiply and fill the earth, and build human communities and survive. You know, a lot of the people who criticize this text live in well-heated houses in the exurbs and gated communities, and they're really don't like these biblical Christians who talk about dominion all the time. But if you're going to have civilization, you're going to have intervention. I think what the Bible is talking about is creative intervention in the earth. My wife and I have had an old farmhouse in Maine for 30 years, and there are some fields around it. And if we're going to have fields, I have to get out there and side those fields every year. It's going to turn into a forest. So if you're going to have fields, you have to tread upon the world. The question is, what is your overall framework for doing that? Let's look at the next word, dominion. I've already suggested that something's going on here in a kind of presiding way. I'm trying to think of the name of the Old Testament scholar, Presbyterian, someone help me, currently writing, most famous American Presbyterian, Walter Brueggemann, points out in his commentary on Genesis that the people who, the tradens, the keepers of the tradition who sort of shaped this material in the exile were writing at the same time as the prophet Ezekiel. And what is Ezekiel's picture of God? What images does Ezekiel? Anyone?
Dry bones to life?
Yeah, dry bones.
Okay. Someone renews the earth, promise of life.
Cosmic.
Yeah, in some sense. What Brueggemann's point is that the image that shapes Ezekiel's thinking about God is the image of the shepherd. So you don't have this domineering, hierarchical, patriarchal deity who's saying, do this, do this, do this. You rather have this presiding, shepherding deity who is ruling them. Now, the assumption is that image of God means image of God. And that, you know, each of these words in these texts, the scholars tell us, are very well chosen. I mean, they've gone over it hundreds of times, and the tradition has shaped it. And so there's almost nothing that's accidental in these texts. So image of God. Are we to image forth this God? And so as we creatively intervene in the earth, we're, in a sense, you know, presiding over the creation, which God has created for God's own purposes. Now here's a nuance that I think is there in Genesis 1, but it only becomes really clear when you read Genesis 1 in parallel to another text that is going to be looked at in this later this morning in another class, that is Psalm 104. Scholars really have established a whole variety of ways that the materials that come from Genesis 1 and are shaped in the exile are the same materials that are the same kind of vision of the world that shape Psalm 104. So that the two can be read in parallel with each other. And that would be an assignment, by the way, from this class, that being here especially, not only read Genesis 1, but Psalm 104, and read it out loud to yourself or to others. So, and here emerges this grand picture of the whole cosmos. And I call your attention, I think it's verse 21. But anyway, it's about sea monsters. Why did God create the sea monsters? One of the translations is to sport with them, okay? And that's possible because sea monsters are these mythological beasts, and it's a kind of a joke played on the mythologies of the surrounding peoples. But I think there's more to it. It can mean, be interpreted as rejoice in it. God created the sea monsters to rejoice in them, not unlike what we see going on in Genesis 1, and God saw it was very good. He said, I did a good job. I mean, that was wonderful. Look at this whole history that's going on. So I would like you to entertain the thought that what's going on in Genesis 1 is the unfolding of God's purpose to have a history with all things. And hence in 131, you have God, so the whole thing was very good. And that dominion now is to be read in this context. That the human creature is called to reflect God's dominion. Now, it's important here to differentiate a couple of things. Let me raise the question of animals. What day were the animals created on?
Sixth day.
Good for you. What day were the humans created on?
Sixth day.
Does that suggest something? That there is a kind of a commonality, at least, with the animals and the humans. Luther, in his Genesis commentary, imagines the animals and Adam and Eve having a common table. Because, of course, they're all vegetarians, according to this text. I mean, there's no violence in this primeval world. So the animals are created. There's even a commonality of terminology. If I recall correctly, we have at least one Hebrew scholar in our midst who can correct me, but I think the Hebrew is nefesh hayah, that that humans are created as a living soul, and so are animals. Animals are also a living soul. So you have a certain kind of commonality on the sixth day. From Luther's point of view, a certain fellowship, even, with other kind. So now, again, come back to dominion. In what sense, if you have a common table, in what sense are you having dominion? Well, maybe you're at the head of the table, I don't know, to pursue that. But everyone's part of God's history with the whole creation. Did the good, dominion, subdue. Okay, let's have a free-for-all on anything in Genesis 1 that didn't get to the Sabbath. Critical part, we can maybe talk about that. Be aware that Sabbath theology has its own history. And as the Bible unfolds, part of the whole earth is given its Sabbath. The fallow years, the every 7 years, and then the Jubilee, where everything is given a Sabbath. So that also has ecological ramification. Yeah?
When you're talking about the eschatological view of the Sabbath, you mean theologians here are suggesting that God's Sabbath hasn't yet ended, or God's Sabbath day hasn't yet begun?
Both. It is
already not yet.
That's right. Already not yet, said the Bible's God. And that this is not biblical, you know, this is just me reading this text, that there's a kind of a magnetic quality of drawing the history forward, that the Sabbath is where it's going. And then this is picked up in the prophets, and like Isaiah 11, the lamb will lie down with the lion, and so on. So that we're moving toward a world, a final realized world of shalom, of peace in that sense. And that's what drives the whole history. That would be how I would read these texts, yeah.
Well, and that would suggest then that we may still be in the sixth day. God is continuing to create, and he is now asking us to help him in this creation. And that would be another
version of what dominion is possible. And I commend that reading as a thought experiment. And I sort of think that the priestly writers who sort of put this whole thing together and then brought in the story of the garden as part of it had that thing in mind. The story of the garden, which we'll get to tomorrow, is yet another development or another exfoliation of what's going on in this overall process. So we're in the sixth day. Many early Christian theologians, all the way up through Augustine, thought of the creation this way, that God sort of brought all things together and had this history with everything. And then lately, we emerged on the scene, we humans, and then we screwed it up, and God had to really sort of reshape that. But he's taking the whole thing toward this eternal world of shalom. And we are in the sixth day. And that has ramifications, too, for how we look at scientific evolution and all things like this, which I look at as being in consonance, that is, that we can have conversations between a biblical view of creation history and a scientific view of cosmic evolution and so forth.
Would you comment on human beings created last in the story? Or isn't that significant? Is that purposeful?
Well, it depends what's most important. I mean, that this is one of the readings that in a significant portion of the tradition has been taken for granted. God finally got around to doing what's really important. I don't see that in the text. There is this, and you know, you could say I'm biased and everything else, but it's a much more ecological text.
Yeah,
well, yeah. That we're part of it. And then when we get to Genesis 2, which the priestly writer put there, we're told why we were put there. And we'll get to that tomorrow.
But it also places a human being as totally dependent upon everything else.
You know, you come from the earth, you're dependent on
exactly, but you're also dependent upon every other creature that's been created.
Oh, that's a very helpful insight.
Yeah. Westerman talks about
You're the most dependent, in a sense, on everything else. And if you think of human fragility and the infant and all the rest, that text, that interpretation would make a lot of sense. Yeah.
Another way of thinking of it is that the last thing to be created is the Sabbath, when everything rests and there is no working and everything is in harmony together, so that God's blessing of the entire creation is that humans aren't the ultimate kind of last thing to be created, but this world, the entire ecosystem is.
Yeah. Amen to that.
Held in gratitude.
It is a very Sabbath-centered theology, is it not? This. Yeah.
Didn't we as Americans, though, get into an eighth day idea that we're beyond that? Karen Strum might help me remember this, but Rosemary Bradford Ruther sat right there in a forum and basically said that in 1969, that, you know, we're no longer part of the guilty century that Luther was part of. We've gotten beyond that. Roland Bainton was sitting next to her, the Luther scholar. No, the 20th century is the guilty century. Of course, this was before Cambodia, before Rwanda, before Iraq. I don't know what.
Well, there is a tradition of the eighth day. Early Christian baptistries were built octagonally. And why? Why eight shapes?
Tell me. There's eight notes in an octave. Is that
it? Okay, we're in the New Testament now. We've got Jesus. We've got the now baptistries. We got Seventh Day.
New creation.
Yeah. The resurrection is not on the Sabbath.
Yeah.
So you have this a new creation, which is a kind of an ex nihilo new beginning of the final fulfillment. So Christian tradition has the eighth day. And it's just now what Americans have done with it as the New Eden, Thoreau and Muir and Manifest Destiny. We're gonna have this world, who's the classic painter, the lamb will lie down with the lion, Hicks. The Isaiah 11. This is Isaiah 11 here in America, and hence American exceptionalism, hence our being a light to the nations. So American society has taken that eighth day theology and made it into an ideology. So it's very problematic, and I'm sure Rosemary Ruther has, if she ever meant to say that, would never say it again.
I was 69.
It's helpful to couple the dominion assigned to humanity with the rule assigned to sun and moon and the co-creation assigned to earth and water.
Uh-huh.
Because then what we're talking about in dominion is something of God, rather than the failed attempts at dominion we experience in human history. So I appreciate that part of your revisionist presentation, that what we're really called to is something that is a co-creation versus a lordship over.
You know, we want to be really careful about that co-creation thing.
Yeah.
Has to be said in a biblical, as distinct from an industrial Marxist capitalist setting. One thing I forgot to mention about the image of God that I find very striking, and I don't know quite how this fits in, but the scholars tell us that this is a kind of a countercultural text, that in the ancient world, in Egypt and Babylonia, There was only one image of God, and that was the emperor, the godly figure. And so now we have all humans now being bearers of the image of God. And that can go, of course, either way. Are we now going to act like the Egyptian emperors, or are we going to act like, according to other representations of God, say in Philippians 2, where God does not come to call you as a thing to be grasped and gives himself? Are we going to be imitating servanthood or imitating emperorhood? Yeah.
Back to the 6 days, it seemed obvious that that God had to create the biological infrastructure for the very complex life forms of animals and humans to be able to, in fact, exist on the planet. But I also wondered that the vegetation came before the light. I mean, just, you know, practically speaking. But anyway, it just seemed that there's a very profound ecological sequence of this event. And
so it's a common sense thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, all the creeping things and the animals are, in fact, required to make the earth function in a way that will support mammals has to happen first.
Well, this is our reading, because cosmological thinking of ancient times was quite different. One more question.
I was just going to say, but on the other hand, humans are needed for, we give off carbon dioxide, which the plants need. So God created us, the plants relying on us too.
Aren't there other sources of carbon dioxide, though, beyond us?
Tomorrow, I want to get into interpretations of why God put the humans in the garden. To till and to keep is a translation. And I'm going to be trying to convince you that the correct translation is to serve and protect. So that's what we're going to work on tomorrow with Genesis 2. Thank you.